Today's program was brought to you by Whole Foods Market. For more information, visit wholefoodsmarket.com.
Hey, what's up? This is John Norris, and you're listening to the Heritage Radio Network.
Hey, and welcome to the Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel, here today with Harold Dieterle, who most know as the first winner of Top Chef. But a lot of people don't know of his storied and legendary past growing up in Long Island, going to Spain after high school, coming back to the Culinary Institute, and really learning his chops. Harold, thank you for being on.
Thanks, Mike. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Let's start from the beginning. You know, a lot of people know Top Chef, your notoriety there. Yep. Your wonderful restaurants here in New York, Perilla and Kinshop. But where did you start with food? Where did you grow up and what did you start eating?
Well, I mean, I grew up in an Italian-American household and some German influences on my father's side. So I had a lot of very, very rustic food, a lot of home-cooked meals. We didn't go out to eat quite a bit. In fact, I didn't have my first avocado until I was 21, which I think is crazy.
Yeah.
And then, you know, inside high school, I kind of felt the urge to work the angle to meet girls. So I took my, you know, I kind of got into cooking. I always say to meet girls in a home ec class.
Yeah. What was that, middle school, high school?
Yeah, that was very early on in high school, probably when I was about 14, 15 years old.
Did it work?
It was okay. I mean, I wasn't the most popular kid, so
yeah.
I still, my cooking skills and my girl picking up skills weren't, neither were very good at the time.
Do you remember those first dishes that you actually cooked in school?
Yeah, I remember being quite overzealous with the dried parsley and oregano making pizza sauce.
Yeah.
and putting way too much breading on fried chicken.
So yeah. Isn't it amazing how many people start making pizza sauce with dried herbs and cooked tomatoes?
Yeah, crazy.
And then it all of a sudden switches. It changes. Once you have a like acidic San Marzano and fresh herbs, it's never look back.
Oh, I mean, yeah, totally. I mean, especially on you know, a middle school budget, we certainly weren't using good ingredients. I mean
yeah, there was,
you know,
no rooftop garden.
No. And I grew up with a garden in my backyard, so when my mom used to when we used to make pizza at home, we used to use really nice homegrown ingredients, and I was looking at this stuff and, you know, pre-shredded pollo. I was like, what the hell am I gonna do with this?
Well, you used to help your mother do Sicilian Sunday suppers.
Yeah,
what was that like?
Well, you know, it was great. I just didn't have a ton of patience when I was a kid. And, you know, I used to think everything you needed to cook as fast as possible and as quickly as possible. So I think the first time she handed the reins to the sauce over, I burnt it in about 7 minutes. And just on black, I was like, no, it's fine. She's like, you smell that? That smell is burnt.
Yeah. So the speed, where did it come from? Did you watch television? I mean, there weren't really food shows at that time.
No, well, you know, I also grew up playing a good amount of sports, and just, you know, instilled in me in very early age was, you know, the kind of the competitiveness of it. So in my opinion, if you could do something quicker and faster, it was, you know, automatically better.
Yeah. I guess there's no slow and low in sports other than like Monopoly. I don't know, some board games.
You go on your nice, you know, afternoon stroll on the golf course, I suppose, is, you know, very civilized, but aside from that, not so much.
Yeah. So you went through high school still with a focus on food? Did you know what you wanted to do after high school?
Yeah, totally. Total focus on food. Really started to get into it from there. I went to BOCES, Wilson Tech, where I actually spent half my day in high school taking a food preparation class. And we would learn how to, you know, very, very, very basic kitchen skills, some basic knife skills, how to make, you know, your mother's sauces, and then a little more advanced stuff, but nothing too crazy. And then went to the Culinary Institute of America.
Yeah, but in between, you went to Spain.
Yeah, right after high school, went to Spain, Madrid, And, you know, just really spent a lot of time picking peas and watching paella being made.
Yeah.
Never really got to get my hands dirty and do anything terribly exciting.
But how did you get the opportunity to do that?
Well, it was a school trip.
Yeah.
So it was based off of our language class. So we were, you know, bouncing around Spain a bit. I spent a couple days inside Madrid. We went to Sevilla, Toledo, and it was equally about, you know, learning, you know, seeing the sights and the history of Spain as it was for me cooking.
When yeah.
we had some free time, that's what I was doing. I was trying to get myself set up in anywhere I could.
Yeah, and drinking of age.
Yes.
Yeah. I think I did the same trip and ended in like Costa del Sol and Malaga, and
yeah,
I kind of remember that.
Yeah, it was my first ungroomed female experience.
Yeah.
If the girls don't shave their armpits,
yeah,
okay, well, what am I going to do? Just go with it.
So, I mean, Spain had a profound, you know, influence on both your culinary and seemingly lady life.
Oh, yeah.
When you came back to the States and went to the Culinary Institute, did you feel like you had an upper hand at school? Did you feel like you had some kind of education from this real life experience?
Maybe. I mean, I was just very cocky in general. I wasn't a humble kid. So, if I had, I don't think there was any specific reason for it. It was just like, I've always had a lot of confidence cooking.
Yeah. So, I mean, picking peas and watching paella being made aren't really techniques.
No.
So,
no.
Did you actually pick up anything, or did you just pick up the bug more so?
Definitely pick up the bug. Definitely got into it. I would say I didn't really pick up much skills. Maybe some discipline. I got hollered at a lot because I would ask questions. My Spanish was really bad, and I was made fun of a good amount.
Yeah.
But I was okay with that.
Yeah. How's your Spanish now?
It's definitely tending more towards Mexican now.
Yeah.
Yeah, not so much proper Spanish.
It's more
Mexicano.
Yeah, I think I was taught Andalusian.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's out the window.
Yeah.
I think I know more Ecuadorian dialect than I do.
Yeah.
Spanish. So coming to the Culinary Institute, what kind of foundation did you learn?
I mean, it's a great program. I mean, it's, you know, school, like, everybody asks me, you know, culinary school and not culinary school. It's not for everybody. It was definitely for me. I definitely needed discipline. I needed to have a schedule. I needed to be told what to do because I just, at that time, I was ready, in my opinion, to start creating ready menus and be a chef at, you know, the tender age of 19 years old, which... that wasn't really the case.
Yeah. Did you actually write menus at that time? And
I was writing menus. My first job interview, I was a line cook, and I was going to, you know, I had just graduated from school, and I had told a 3-star New York Times chef that I wanted to, the only way I was taking the job was if I was going to be able to participate creatively towards a menu.
Nice.
And it was hysterical, and he like totally... He totally played it off. Like, oh yeah, it'd be great.
Yeah.
He was like, made me think that he was so into it. It was fantastic. And then little I know, like, he had told all the entire kitchen staff that we had had this conversation that I was hired.
Yeah.
And they were destroying me. They were all just like, oh, so like, tell me the special that, and it was like my first day on the job.
Yeah.
I couldn't do shit.
Yeah.
I was getting eaten alive. And they're all like, oh, so tell us about the special you want to run Saturday.
Yeah.
And I'm all fired up. I'm like, yeah, I want to do like a duck confit ravioli with like a blood orange beurre rouge.
Yeah.
And like, we're talking like, this is late April, you know, blood oranges are out of season.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to just pull like, you know, duck confit out of my ass.
Yeah.
And they're all like, oh yeah, let's do it. Let's do it. This is going to be so cool.
Yeah.
And everybody, I was the big joke in town.
Yeah. So, I mean, that was a humbling experience.
Yeah, very humbling. And then for the, you know, remaining 3 months, I lived off antacids because I was getting screamed at so much.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, being in a position like that, how did that reform how you approached restaurants?
Well, I mean, to one degree, I mean, I think there's a time and a place in everybody's career where you're, you know, it's okay to have ideas of grandeur at an early age. But you just kind of need to know where you gotta pay your dues first, and it's okay because your style is always evolving.
Yeah,
and I think that's important. I would rather have a cook that is a bit overzealous about being creative than someone that's just afraid to put themselves out there.
Yeah, but I mean, they still need that foundation.
Got to have a foundation.
So you can't just have creative thoughts without having a way to execute them.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, I agree completely. Sorry, I didn't mean to move.
Yeah.
I agree completely. You know, so many times you have kids that are at a culinary school and they want to get down and dirty with, like, molecular gastronomy, but they don't know how to roast a chicken.
Yeah.
Like, that doesn't work for me.
Yeah. So, your first few jobs, Della Femina in Long Island.
Yeah.
What positions did you hold there?
I was a line cook.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was a line cook. I did about 2 years there. They opened a restaurant inside New York City. And I was a junior sous chef. I was a line cook into a junior sous chef over there. I had also worked at a restaurant called Red Bar, which was a Hamptons restaurant they opened in the city. I was a sous chef there. I did my internship at the Mermaid Inn in Fire Island. I was an intern line cook there. A lot of getting yelled at about the same things from chefs.
Yeah.
And being really arrogant and cocky along the way.
You were at 1770 House.
Yep, 1770 House. It was the same chef that I'd worked for at Della Femina.
Yeah.
We opened that place up, and that was a lot of fun.
Yeah, and I got a 2-star review from the Times.
Yep.
What was it like being in the kitchen that garnered that kind of accolade?
I mean, it was great. It was interesting because it was basically a super small kitchen. It was just me and the chef cooking every night. We were doing, like, really, really beautiful food. I mean, I thought, comparatively speaking to other restaurants that in Long Island, a 2-star review in Long Island is, in my opinion, the equivalent of a 1-star review in New York City. I think it's, you know, goes down about 1 star.
Yeah.
But I thought we were doing, like, really, really, really beautiful food because we were the only people touching it every night, and it was really nice. So
yeah. So I mean, going from the idea of wanting to maybe be a big box chef to a small one, how did that change your mode of thought and how you approached even creating menus?
It was interesting because that was a weird part. It was a bit of a weird time in my life because I was only there for the summer. I was actually at that point feeling a little burnt out in my career. I didn't really know what I'd want to do. I'd worked at Red Bar, and after 9/11, the restaurant had closed, and I was feeling a little burnt out. Like, I don't know if this was for me. This was the only time in my career where I had questions. Like, am I really up for this? Because, you know, that was I'd started cooking, you know, probably 6 years ago. Obviously, you know, we don't do this for the money.
Yeah.
And I was just trying to figure out, you know, like, what am I going to do? Like, so I was there for the summer. I was partying a lot. We were cooking really nice food. I thought the food was much better than the reviews we were getting. And I was terribly frustrated, and I was just ready to get back to the city at that point.
Yeah. And what age were you?
At that point, I was probably about 23, 24.
Yeah. It's amazing, though, that at that young age, a lot of people already feel burnt out. I mean, that's younger than most athletes feel burnt out.
Yeah.
That's younger than most any other profession. Why do you think that is, aside from the crazy hours?
I think the crazy hours are part of it. And I also think, you know, folks in general that dine at restaurants or are passionate about food have a very romantic idea of the restaurant business, where it's, in reality, it's about repetition. In so many places you work at, you're doing very similar things day after day. It's the only way you get good at it. And I feel like you can get burnt out.
Yeah. So how do you break out of that monotony?
Well, for me, it was trying to creating new challenges for myself. And I try and do that for my cooks as well. It's the first kitchen that I've ever, you know, Perillion Kitchen Shop are the first kitchens that I've ever worked in where when I have a menu meeting, it's not just with the sous chefs. I get the whole entire kitchen staff involved. And it also helps for me as a manager to separate the creators from the executors.
Yeah.
You need both. They're both equally important. But, you know, the person... The folks, in my opinion, that are, you know, have longevity are the ones that are going to be able to create and have their own place someday.
Yeah. So who knew that there were all these cogs in the industry?
Yeah.
Like, how many positions you actually had to hold at the same time to be able to be a creative and successful chef?
Yeah. Yeah.
Excellent. Well, we're going to take a quick break. We'll come right back here with Harold Dieterle. I'm Michael Harlander Kellen. You've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
Foods Market, we believe in healthy snacking, eating our veggies, and supporting local. Check out Brad's Raw Chips, a local producer that created irresistible chips after their namesake's successful weight loss with a raw lifestyle. Their chips are gluten-free, nutrient-packed, and so good that you'll think you're indulging. For more information, visit bradsrawchips.com.
Welcome back to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkell, here with Harold D. Lee. We were just talking about promoting within ranks and, you know, mentoring people. It seems like throughout your career, there were a lot of people yelling at you, but at the same time, you had people that pushed you.
Oh, yeah.
In 2002, you accepted a job within the Jimmy Bradley group of restaurants, I think originally at the Harrison.
Yep.
Who was the chef there at that time?
Joey Campanero.
Yeah. Was he a mentor for you?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Him and Jimmy were both mentors in different ways. Joey was really the first chef that I worked for that really trusted me and gave me a lot of room to grow and kind of do whatever I wanted at the restaurant. He also he also personally taught me how to make pasta.
Yeah.
Which up to that point I was clueless. Even though growing up in an Italian American household, we had, you know, strictly really only eating dried pasta, so like the whole world of fresh pasta was an eye-opening experience. And then Jimmy really taught me how to run a business.
Yeah,
which was huge.
How, I mean, what were the first lessons that Jimmy gave you on how to run your own restaurant?
It started very you know, small bite-sized lessons, like how do you do food, like teaching me how to do food cost, teaching me how to write a schedule and labor cost. And then from there it was moving on to, you know, dealing with, I'd always dealt with purveyors and ordering that I had experience doing, but like if something broke, like, you know, what do you do when you know, shit's always breaking.
Yeah.
In the restaurants, always breaking. Like I wish I had all that time to spend in the kitchen that I'm dealing with technicians on the phone. Like, what happens when the HVAC goes down or a refrigerator goes down, or there's a fire in the kitchen and I need to, you know, handle something. I remember within a 6-month period at the Harrison, I had dealt with a fire in the kitchen, I had dealt with a flood, and a snowstorm.
Yeah.
and someone that...
Snowstorm in the kitchen?
No. Yeah, snowstorm in the kitchen. And a guest that I had to go into the dining room, break up a fight between a bartender and a guest. Someone mysteriously the next day threw like a cinder block through a window.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
So it was, you know, it was just crazy. Like, you know, he's like, okay, this is who you call. Like, tell them we need to get this window fixed ASAP. And it just happened. So
yeah. And when you find a good HVAC guy, a good plumbing guy, a good repair guy, you hold on to them. They're like gold, right?
Yeah, you hold on to them. It was interesting because, you know, I wasn't on the billing side of things, so I don't know what these people were actually charging at the time. But yeah, he had his core group of guys, so it was a good experience for me.
Yeah. So Joey taught you fresh pasta. You eventually were cooking underneath Brian Bistrong too.
Yep.
how did these guys mentor you? How did they bring you along? Because you're in a position now with two restaurants, a whole bunch of people under you that you're trying to promote within the ranks and trying to, you know, push people to doing creative things of their own.
See, it was interesting because Joey grew up in a similar household that I did, in an Italian-American family as well. Joey really knew how to manage me, and he very much had me under control. Brian is one of the nicest guys I've ever worked for. He had a bit of a tougher time managing me because I was, you know, I caused problems.
Yeah.
I caused problems at the time. You know, I was, you know, fraternizing with the hostess staff and the wait staff. I was, you know, young single sous chef. So he had a much tougher time managing me, but I learned a lot. I learned a lot from his, you know, classical French technique, and it was great.
Yeah. So, when you moved on from there, was it literally a leap into opening your own places, or was that when Top Chef happened?
That I was at the Harrison when Top Chef happened. It happened in 2000. I think I filmed in 2005. I think I got back November 2005, like right before Thanksgiving, and Brian had worked, you know, like literally 2 weeks straight while I was filming. So I kind of walked back right like 2 days before Thanksgiving with 30 turkeys to butcher, and he's like, "All right, have fun. I'll see you after Thanksgiving.
Welcome back." Little did he know that you won.
Well, I didn't know. I actually didn't know I had won either. I knew I was in the finals, but they hadn't shot the finale yet.
Yeah. So, how were your approach? How did you apply for Top Chef?
A friend of mine who was in television saw an ad for it, and she was like, "You should do this. You know, you're very competitive. You're, you know, kind of a sports guy."
Yeah.
And it kind of just makes sense, you know, cooking as a competition for me. And I you know, went to an open call for it. I had the producer, you know, producer was asking me for a headshot and, you know, if I had a bio, and I was like, "I don't have any of that stuff. I'm like, I'm a cook."
Yeah.
I was like, "Why don't you come to the Harris and let me cook for you?"
Yeah.
And then it seemed to go pretty well. I'd met them the next day. They put me on camera, and I was kind of a wild man.
Yeah.
And they seemed to eat it up.
Wild man in what way?
I got myself pretty caffeinated, and I was, you know, jawing off all sorts of nonsense, and they were like, "Oh, this guy's going to be great. He's totally made for TV."
Yeah. But do you feel like you were kind of portrayed a little more subdued on air?
Well, it's just more of me being down the business in the kitchen. I don't really like to play around.
Well, did you come in with a methodology?
I definitely came in with, you know, definitely had a methodology and a game plan, because it's like, you know, you see the Hell's Kitchen, what people want to see.
Yeah.
It's not really the quiet guy.
But there weren't shows like that before Top Chef. I mean,
they had a season of Hell's Kitchen under their belt before it.
So you kind of based it off of that.
Yeah.
Now seeing, you know, how all these shows have proliferated, do you see people go on those shows? Do you even watch those shows?
No.
No. I've seen a few.
Well, it's embarrassing. Yeah. I know what it's like to go through it. It's such a crazy experience, and you know, some folks that have been on the show will come up to me and introduce themselves, and I really have no idea who they are.
Yeah,
I really should, but I just don't follow it.
Yeah, I mean, what were the toughest things that happened during that show aside from just cooking competitions?
I think the cooking is the easiest part. I think, you know, for me, I was very much set in my ways. I hadn't had a roommate in, you know, over 10 years, and now I'm in a room with four beds, four crazies, all sleeping on a twin size bed. Somebody snoring. I'm just like, what am I doing here?
Yeah,
that was challenging. It's the cooking was a very, very small aspect of it. Like there was, you know, a lot of cameras in there. The producers are trying to stir up the kettle a little bit, get people to talk some trash about each other, and I just wasn't into it.
Yeah. So we'll gloss over all those episodes because people could see them. Yeah. I've actually never seen season one. I've actually never really even seen a whole episode of Top Chef.
Wow.
Don't really have TV. But I'd rather be talking face-to-face and learning from those people and, cool, you know, being on the ground. But what did Top Chef do for you other than maybe winning the money or getting notoriety that helped you open a restaurant? Did you change your idea of how you cooked or how you approached business?
I would say definitely not. I mean, I had a very specific idea of what I wanted to do. I always wanted to do, you know, a very comfortable neighborhood place. I think a lot of people, after, you know, it being, you know, me being attached to television, were expecting something very flashy and very large and very loud. That's not me at all.
Yeah.
I definitely wanted to do something something a little more restraint, and you know, I'm kind of a laid back guy, so.
Yeah. So, I mean, did you take any signature dishes from the show and bring them to the restaurant?
No, I mean, you know, honestly, like, the parameters at the time that you're cooking under are so challenging. Like, you only have specific ingredients. Like, I had a style developed, you know, prior to going on to the show. And I don't think that really changed after I was on it.
Yeah. Perillo opened up in 2006. Kinshop in what, 2010?
Yep.
You have a couple other restaurant idea projects in your mind right now?
Yeah, we're working on a meat restaurant right now.
Yeah.
Which I'm very excited about. It'll be, you know, something that it kind of goes back to just cooking, you know, cooking and food as a kid. A meat-focused restaurant with a lot of German and Italian influences.
Excellent. Are there trips that have influenced that, other restaurants? Because I know when you were opening up Kinshop, it was because you had traveled to Thailand a whole bunch. When did you start traveling to Thailand, and what was it that enamored you about that?
Well, I'd taken it when I was actually still in high school. I had taken a trip to New York City, and I ate at my first Thai restaurant. I couldn't even tell you the name of the restaurant. I have no idea where it was. We literally got on the train. We were all, you know, underage drinking on the train.
Yeah.
That's what you do. We got out of Penn Station, got into a cab. We're like, asked the cab driver to take us to his favorite Thai restaurant. I don't know why. So we just...
Was he even Thai?
No,
was
he wasn't. Yeah. He wasn't Thai. Yeah. I just, I guess what you do.
Yeah.
When you're stupid and, you know, 17 years old.
Yeah.
So we sat down, ordered some drinks, and just started eating Thai food. And I was just, I couldn't tell you if it was good Thai food. The flavors were just so different than anything I had experienced at the time.
Yeah.
And, from there, I really started to research Thai food to a degree. Ate at, you know, the restaurants aren't open anymore. They used to have two restaurants, one in the West Village called Little Basil, and then Holy Basil on 2nd Avenue and 9th Street, which is recently closed. Those were my two favorite Thai restaurants for quite a while. And then in 2003, while I was at the Harrison, I decided to take a trip to Thailand.
Yeah.
And I had no guide. I didn't have anybody. I went there by myself and just kind of cooked around and ate around.
Yeah.
And it was very similar to my experience in Spain, where I was staying at a really nice hotel. I spoke to the concierge. I was like, do you think I could hang out in the kitchen? He's like, sure. I went to the kitchen. I was at the Amari Watergate. The corporate chef happened to be hanging through there. I think he was a New Zealand guy who was the only person in there that spoke kitchen. He was also the only male. It was an all-woman kitchen.
Yeah.
And I kind of just hung out and I picked herbs.
Yeah.
And watched.
Yeah. Do you think, well, I mean, yeah, it harkens back to like what you said in Spain. You did some medial task and watched. I mean, there's so much you can just soak in visually.
Yeah. Well, at that time I had some experience and some techniques.
Yeah.
I will say that I was able to watch them and you know, watching them make curry paste.
Yeah.
And you know, seeing how they make curries and watching them press their own coconut milk. And so I was actually, you know, educated enough to the point where I could learn. Where I was in Spain, I was just ignorant, didn't know anybody.
Yeah. So when, you know, people look around and get stages and they get bummed out if they don't get them, do you suggest that people just go out in the field and watch and, you know, do the medial tasks but be around food?
Yeah. I mean, no one, you know, especially young cooks nowadays, just like they're, oh boy, how to not come off as an old man. I mean, they're just like so soft. Like they don't want to just do it and just get their hands dirty. Like I have so many cooks that I'll set a stage up with, or I'll set a kitchen trail up, and they just don't even show up.
Yeah.
And it's all email. It's like no face-to-face. There's no one that like comes beating down your door with a resume in their hand and says, I want a job, or yeah, I want to be here.
Not to open up the floodgates, but I mean, if someone came to your restaurant right now, to Perilla or Kinshop, said, hey, can I just spend the day in the kitchen? Would you let them?
Absolutely. I have, you know, all sorts of interns and stages there at all times.
So it doesn't take a specific degree or, you know,
Everybody's entitled to a shot and see what we're doing.
Yeah, excellent. Well, love and Kinshop.
Cool.
Can't wait till this meat restaurant's open up, and Perilla is that neighborhood restaurant we were all hoping for.
Cool. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for being on, and I hope to see you again soon. Maybe sure. I'll be the one coming to
sounds great,
your door.
Thank you very much.
Thanks again. You've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel. Hoping to have you back here next Tuesday at 3. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.